more fighting in Ukraine, and the reality of Western weapons.
The range of both missiles is enough to get behind Russian lines and into Russian infrastructure targets.
Even as he's set to take over the White House, Donald Trump has unfinished business at the courthouse.
Trump's defense team is arguing that a landmark Supreme Court ruling in July grants him presidential immunity, and that the case should be dismissed entirely.
And what would motivate someone to leave their home and risk their life to move to a new country?
Primeira tentativa, eu
the first time, eu I não did consigo. Not get in,
eu
but I went back to the border.
Na fronteira.
Today is Thursday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. It was a tense day in Kyiv. The United States and several other countries temporarily closed their embassies amid threats of an incoming Russian attack. This follows news that Ukraine had fired British-supplied long-range missiles into Russia for the first time, just after U.S. President Joe Biden earlier this week approved the use of American longer-range missiles on targets deep inside Russia. Henry Ridgewell has the story from London.
British media reported Wednesday that Ukraine had fired Storm Shadow missiles supplied by Britain into Russian territory for the first time. The weapons had been used against Russian forces in occupied Ukraine, including this attack on Russia's former Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Crimea last year. London and Kyiv refused to confirm the latest reports. Earlier this week, Ukraine's forces fired US-supplied longer-range ATACMS missiles deep into Russian territory after Washington gave the go-ahead Sunday. France has also supplied Ukraine with its version of the Storm Shadow missiles, known as Scalp. The European missiles differ from the American ATACMS, says defense analyst Patrick Berry of the University of Bath.
They're air-launched missiles, but generally, depending on the export variant, usually got a range of 250 kilometers, 155 miles or so. I think that given the ATACMS has a longer range than that and isn't air launched, so therefore it's harder to intercept, in theory at least.
Both weapon systems will open a range of new targets. James Nixey leads the Russia-Eurasia program at Chatham House.
The range of both missiles is enough to get behind Russian lines and into Russian infrastructure targets, so that will cut off their supplies to their front line. So the actual range of each missile is not as significant as the fact that Ukraine needs them in great quantity and very fast indeed.
Ukraine will have to select its targets carefully, says analyst Berry.
Are you going to allow them to actually up the ante and start hitting energy infrastructure, you know, military infrastructure, stuff that will, you know, oil refineries, etc., stuff that would really start to hurt the Russian economy? That's the question.
Meanwhile, Germany, Ukraine's second biggest supplier of arms, this week ruled out giving Kyiv its long-range Taurus cruise missiles. Berlin fears being dragged into the war.
Nothing had changed for us. The situation, the circumstances are the same. And Taurus is Taurus and not ATACMS or Storm Shadow. So our perspective on that issue is the same.
The future of Western military aid to Kyiv remains uncertain. US President-elect Donald Trump has pledged to end the war on his first day in office. Kyiv fears US support may be cut. Britain and France could opt to continue supplying Ukraine with missiles, says Berry.
They're both nuclear powers. They can take that risk if they want to, leaning into it. I think you're going to find, you might find a divergence between European NATO and the US NATO on some policy issues around Ukraine.
Following Washington's decision to approve Ukrainian missile strikes inside Russia, Moscow this week lowered its threshold for the use of nuclear weapons. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
In the days since Biden changed his policy and allowed Kyiv to use American-supplied weapons on targets inside Russia, the fighting has intensified. This isn't surprising when looking at the bigger picture. As my next guest says, Biden is trying to give Kyiv more leverage against Russia once President-elect Trump returns to office. Dalibor Rohak is a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute.
Also, on the one hand, the decision to authorize Ukrainians to use ATACMS on Russian territory against targets that might be deep inside Russian territory comes on the back of extended conversations and debates and bargaining happening in the administration, which was very similar to the earlier iterations of the same debate over F-16s, over tanks, over various other weapon systems that we eventually provided to the Ukrainians. So it does not really depart from the approach that the administration has displayed towards escalation management.
But why now?
It comes also against the background of the election result and the fact that we know that the president-elect probably will not see Ukraine's victory as his priority. And he seems committed to pursuing negotiations that might actually put Ukraine at a disadvantage at a time when Russians are making steady those small advances on the battlefield. So there is some urgency in the administration and also among European governments in, you know, using this window of two months to give Ukraine at least some leverage on the battlefield. And it can have leverage if it holds on to this small sliver of Russian territory, which can then be traded for perhaps some other concessions at the negotiating table.
So are the weapons enough? Will Ukraine have leverage going into peace talks if they were to happen?
Unfortunately, the administration's approach throughout this conflict was really to be, a week too late and the weapons system too short in helping Ukraine. So this most recent authorization is not enough to turn the tide of the war, obviously, but it might, give Ukraine a small advantage on the battlefield and as a result at the negotiating table.
Now, there are plenty of people out there saying that the United States defending Ukraine and the United States supporting its NATO allies and working against Russia together actually is in America's best interest and could be considered an America First style policy. You're saying Donald Trump doesn't ascribe to that view?
He does not, and I think he has made himself very clear in that regard. And I think the source of the disagreement really lies in whether one considers American interest in Europe to be, as relevant as they once were, whether one sees the U.S. commitment to NATO as being relevant for America's interest in the 21st century. If you ascribe to the view that we should take alliance obligations seriously, it is fairly clear that the Ukrainian defeat in this war will make NATO's job much harder, will make also America's position within NATO much more difficult. And therefore, it is only logical that we would wish for Ukraine to prevail, to defeat Russia, to restore its borders. A world in which Ukraine is unable to retake its territory and where Russian aggression goes unpunished is arguably going to be a much more unstable world, one in which revisionists, be it in Asia, be it in Europe, will try to push the envelope further. And I think that's the argument that I think needs to be made to the incoming administration.
Dalibor Rohak is a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. His latest article appears in the New York Post. Mr. Rohak, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Meanwhile, many Ukrainians welcome the U.S. decision to let Ukraine strike deep into Russian territory. But on the streets of Ukraine's capital, many also say it's too little, too late. For VOA, Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
Ukraine has yet to confirm that long-range missiles it received from the U.S. struck targets in Russia, as the Kremlin claims. But on the streets of Kyiv, residents reacted to the news that the Biden administration had lifted restrictions against the use of Army Tactical Missile System, or ATACMS, in the war against Russia.
We've waited a long time for this decision. This will allow us to conduct deep strikes and destroy their infrastructure, airfields, manpower, and military equipment so that they will use it less against us.
Our opinion is, why that late? If it weren't so late, we probably wouldn't be in the situation we are in now. There wouldn't be damaged energy infrastructure. There wouldn't be massive power outages. If this had been done earlier, the front line wouldn't be where it is now.
With uncertainty growing about the future of U.S. support, some see negotiation as inevitable. This resident says the latest developments could help.
Maybe there will be some relief. Maybe Kursk will remain under our control and negotiations will be about territories. We will exchange them.
The sense of urgency is growing as Russia escalates its assault with the help of North Korean troops and strikes on Ukraine's energy grid. In remarks marking the 1,000th day of Russia's full-scale invasion, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged Western allies to keep pressure on Russia.
Every today is the best moment to push Russia harder. He will not stop on his own. The more time he has, the worse the conditions become.
Some analysts say even at this stage of the war, it's important to have the ability to strike deep inside Russia. Mykhailo Samus is the director of the New Geopolitics Research Network.
I think that this decision should be made 1,000 days ago, when actually the full-scale operation against Ukraine, Russia started. And why? Because from military point of view, it's absolutely logically to destroy military infrastructure of your enemy in depth.
Mykhailo Samus and others see authorization for the missile launches as a show of Western strength and resolve against Russian aggression. But as Ukraine braces for a long winter, there is also uncertainty about the future and the prospect of diminished U.S. support after the January transfer of power in Washington. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
In a State of the Nation address late Tuesday, outgoing Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi invited the four presidential candidates for a dialogue as part of a bid to end post-election unrest that has left several people dead and dozens of others injured. Protesters say the October 9th election, won by ruling party candidate Daniel Chapo, was rigged. The government denies the accusation.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has arrived in Guyana, marking the first visit by an Indian leader in more than 50 years to the South American country with deep diaspora ties. Guyana serves as headquarters for the 15-member Caribbean trade bloc known as CARICOM, and Modi met with the regional leaders there on Wednesday.
Leaders of the main opposition parties in Congo have called for nationwide protests against President Felix Tshisekedi's plans to draft a new constitution. Last month, he announced that a national commission will be set up next year to draft a new constitution, raising concern among the opposition over possible altering of the presidential term limit. Tshisekedi was re-elected last December, with results widely questioned by the opposition. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Turning now to the United States and American politics. You might remember back in May, former President Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to suppress damaging information ahead of his 2016 election. The sentencing for that case was delayed until after the election. But now that he's president-elect, what happens next is less clear. Tina Trin reports from New York.
Will President-elect Donald Trump be sentenced for his crimes? It's a question that remains to be answered, as New York State Judge Juan Merchan considers the extraordinary circumstances of a former U.S. president and convicted felon, who also happens to be the incoming president. In May, Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels to suppress his sex scandal ahead of his 2016 election. Trump's sentencing in the so-called Hush Money case has been delayed multiple times, and his election victory earlier this month cast further doubt on legal proceedings. Anna Kaminsky is a professor at New York Law School.
Really, the core of this is to find out whether or not Trump's sentencing is going to move forward at all, and that includes whether it will happen before he takes office, whether it will happen after he takes office, or whether his case will just be dismissed.
Trump's defense team is arguing that a landmark Supreme Court ruling in July grants him presidential immunity and that the case should be dismissed entirely. But Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is arguing that the jury arrived at a guilty verdict prior to the Supreme Court ruling and that Trump was not president at the time. In a letter to the judge, he indicated that prosecutors would oppose attempts to dismiss the case, but were open to delaying sentencing until after Trump's term in office. Claire Finkelstein is a law professor at University of Pennsylvania.
If Juan Merchan decides that he agrees with the prosecutor's suggestion as a possibility, then he would engage in what might be termed an equitable stay, stay of proceedings, in light of the extraordinary circumstances of the defendant becoming a president of the United States, and he would effectively stay the case until 2029 after Donald Trump steps down from the presidency.
The hush money case isn't the only one the president-elect must contend with. Two federal cases brought forth by special counsel Jack Smith, one alleging mishandling of classified documents and another election interference, are reportedly being brought to a close as a longstanding Department of Justice policy cites that sitting presidents cannot be charged with a crime. However, an election interference case in Georgia does not fall under federal jurisdiction. Again, Claire Finkelstein.
Technically, the state of Georgia is free to proceed, unencumbered by the DOJ policy. But can they? Is it even possible to expect that they would be able to proceed and expect the cooperation of Donald Trump, which would really require the cooperation of the White House, to proceed with a trial while the defendant is serving as president of the United States?
Unprecedented circumstances have made for uncharted legal territory. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
On Wednesday morning, thousands of Central and South American migrants embarked on a journey from southern Mexico, walking north in a bid to reach the United States border before President-elect Trump takes office, aiming to avoid potential immigration control measures.
Bueno, tenemos miedo de que no podamos pasar por...
That's Yanin Rodriguez, a migrant from Honduras. He says they are afraid they won't be able to pass the border because of Trump and that he trusts in God to do the impossible. Experts say poverty and hunger are major factors in the global migration crisis. On the sidelines of the G20 summit in Brazil, they said that putting in place effective social safety nets in poorer countries can help mitigate the root causes that compel people to leave their homes and risk their lives. VOA's immigration reporter Alini Barros has more from Rio de Janeiro.
Steve Said was a political science student in Haiti. He left in 2023 because there were no jobs there. Security was a concern. The 22-year-old says he needed to try for a better life.
Because the situation there is difficult. I chose Brazil because I heard of work opportunities and how welcome Brazilian people are.
To get to Brazil, he crossed without documentation into the Dominican Republic. He says it was dangerous and expensive.
The first time, I did not get in, but I went back to the border.
Said spent a month in the Dominican Republic. He worked and saved money. After a month, he got a humanitarian visa and now lives in Brazil seeking economic stability.
In life, you can't stop. If you need to get somewhere, you have to fight until the end.
According to the Brazilian Federal Police, about 164,000 Haitians live in the country. And as Brazil hosts leaders from the world's 20 largest economies at their summit in Rio de Janeiro, experts say G20 countries need to have ready the resources to integrate migrants into their new homes.
Paulo Illis is the founder of the Center for Human Rights and Immigration Citizenship in São Paulo.
That must always be addressed from a human rights perspective. Additionally, G20 leaders should acknowledge that migration also occurs due to structural issues such as poverty, environmental disasters, wars, and conflicts.
In its declaration, the G20 agreed it is important to prevent irregular migration and respond to the root causes of displacement, such as hunger and poverty. Wellington Dias, Brazil's development minister, says 2.4 billion people worldwide live in poverty.
But beyond the migration issue, I always argue that hunger and poverty are not just problems for those who are hungry or living in poverty. It is a problem for middle class, for the wealthy, for rich countries, and for wealthy individuals.
Gia says people in desperate need might turn to crime, creating problems for everyone. So a key initiative at the summit is the creation of the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty.
The alliance aims to provide cash transfers for 500 million people and school meals for 150 million children. More than 80 countries, 24 international organizations, 9 international financial institutions, and 31 philanthropies have joined so far.
It is no longer just giving food baskets. We are talking about implementing a development plan that must address education, which is a key foundation for eradicating poverty, as well as health, the economy, job creation, and infrastructure.
According to the United Nations, the relationship between food insecurity, migration, and displacement is heavily influenced by climate change, natural disasters, conflicts, and poverty, the major themes during Brazil's G20 summit. Aline Barros, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
It's not just Central and South America. Migration is happening all over the world, and for many reasons. Earlier in the week, we heard about Syrian refugees who fled the Syrian civil war and sought refuge in Lebanon, but now are returning to Syria amid the ongoing war between Israel and Hezbollah. There are also African migrants, particularly women in Lebanon, who left their home seeking a better life, but who now face the dangers of war and an uncertain future. Marcus Harton narrates this report from Ethel Bonnet.
An abandoned factory in Beirut has become a refuge for more than 200 African migrant women displaced by the escalating conflict. They came seeking work to support their families. The fighting has left them jobless, homeless, and unable to return home. Sisha Sware is a worker from Sierra Leone.
I came here to change the situation of my family. That's why I came to Lebanon. My salary, they get hold of my salary. They don't give me my money. I don't have anywhere to go now. Since they start this bomb, we don't have anywhere to go. We have been sleeping in the streets.
These women are not only losing their jobs, but are also enduring the trauma of constant rocket attacks. Explosions forced them to flee their homes and places of work with no resources or support. Zainab Ba is a worker from Sierra Leone.
After 1 minute, then we hear a bomb sound, boom, boom. When we came out, we want to see what is happening, we see the bomb. And there is a lot of smoke and there is a lot of fires. I'm so in the shock, I'm so nervous. So everybody's crying in my country so that I can go back home. I need to go back home. I have my baby. It's so little.
Thanks to a community initiative, these women now have a place to stay. While they still face social rejection and a lack of official support, activists say. Lee Gorayeb is a humanitarian activist in Beirut who is working with the migrants.
Since they are all migrant workers living in Lebanon, no one would accept them in their shelters. So it was very hard to find a space for them, but we finally did.
The situation is similar for other African migrants, including those from war-torn Sudan. Around 50 families who fled fighting near the Israeli border have found temporary refuge in an ancient monastery on Mount Lebanon. Abdel Rahim is from Sudan. He and his twin children are cramped into a small space. Like others, he feels trapped and abandoned. He says, "We cannot go to Sudan. There is war there. There is war here and there, which means I'm doomed. It's so hard. Our situation is dire. No one is asking about us. Nothing." The conflict has displaced more than a million people. Migrant workers in Lebanon are facing an uncertain future as the humanitarian crisis deepens with no end in sight. For Attel Bonnet in Beirut, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for listening.